Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who talks about the findings in a new report he co-authored with Jeffrey Sachs on the deadly impact of U.S. sanctions on the Venezuelan people. Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive turned whistleblower, who examines what the nation's insurance industry will be saying and doing to oppose the establishment of a universal single-payer healthcare system in the U.S., such as Medicare for All. And youth climate strike activist Mitchell Kuvidar and Connecticut State Representative Robin Porter, who call for urgent local state action to address climate change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Four widows of the Ogoni Nine, environmental campaigners who were executed by the Nigerian government in the 1990s, have won the right to press their case against Royal Dutch Shell in a Netherlands court. The ruling now requires Shell to turn over confidential internal documents regarding their dealings with the Nigerian military, which led to the execution of the Ogoni Nine activists, which included award-winning environmental activist Ken Sarowiwa. The case against Shell was originally filed in U.S. courts in 2002, but the U.S. Supreme Court ruled it was filed in the wrong jurisdiction. With the aid of Amnesty International, the widows refiled their case in Dutch courts in The Hague. Shell has long denied any complicity in the deaths of the Ogoni activists or other rights abuses. In 2009, Shell reached an out-of-court settlement for $16 million with the family of Ken Sarowiwa. The case by the Ogoni widows claims Shell was complicit with the Nigerian military's brutal crackdown in the oil-rich Niger Delta, reacting to a grassroots campaign to pressure Shell to clean up their massive oil pollution. During the crackdown, Nigerian security forces were implicated in 50 extrajudicial executions, as well as rape and torture. Liberian environmental lawyer Alfred Brownell won the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize for defending over 500,000 acres of tropical forests from palm oil developers in one of the planet's 25 most important biodiversity hotspots. In 2010, Liberian President Ellen John Sirleaf signed a lease with Singapore-based Golden Veroleum Liberia to produce palm oil. The government leased undeeded land in the Upper Guinean Forest, historically inhabited by indigenous communities who were vulnerable to agro-industrial and mining projects. In the process, GVL destroyed farmland and polluted fresh water supplies. Local protests quickly broke out against GVL's activities. Brownell, executive director of Green Advocates in Liberia, worked with indigenous leaders to block certification of GVL's Liberia project by the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil. Without the Roundtable's certification of its plantations, GVL could not sell their palm oil to major buyers like Unilever or Cargill. In July 2018, the Roundtable upheld its initial stop work order against GVL. Brownell's efforts prevented the deforestation of more than 500,000 acres of land that sequesters carbon and shelters endangered species. But due to death threats in Liberia, Brownell and his family have been forced to seek asylum in the U.S. As President Donald Trump seeks $4.5 billion in new funding to deal with the spike of asylum seekers turning themselves in at the U.S.-Mexico border, thousands of family detention beds remain empty. Despite this surplus of beds, the Department of Homeland Security insists it needs to build more facilities to house migrants arriving from Central America. The 96-bed Burks facility near Reading, Pennsylvania, for example, is now only at 25% capacity. According to data from ICE, the facility currently houses six families. Its population fell dramatically in late 2018 as the flood of asylum seekers from Central America dramatically increased. According to the American Prospect, there is similar surplus capacity at large facilities in Texas. Immigration attorney Karen Hoffman of ALDEA, the People's Justice Center, says that while we don't think families should be detained at all, we do find it striking that the administration is claiming the U.S. is at capacity when these facilities sit almost empty. She concludes that it wouldn't be far-fetched to assume ICE is trying to exaggerate the extent of the crisis. It's clear that the Department of Homeland Security has made a conscious decision to push hard to boost detention capacity over the option of expanding low-cost supervised family release programs. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Over the last several months, the Trump administration, through Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Special Envoy Elliot Abrams, have been working quite openly to overthrow the government of Venezuela's socialist president Nicolas Maduro. The latest attempt to oust Maduro came on April 30th, when U.S.-backed self-declared President Juan Guaido called for the Venezuelan military to revolt and participate in a coup. But that effort in the glare of world media failed. In recent years, Venezuela, gripped by economic collapse, has seen some 3 million of its citizens flee the country. The nation's economic crisis can be traced to several important factors, including a dramatic fall in the price of oil, Venezuela's number one export, government mismanagement, charges of corruption, and the imposition of harsh U.S. economic sanctions. The impact of these sanctions is the subject of a new report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. The report, titled Economic Sanctions as Collective Punishment, The Case of Venezuela, finds that U.S. sanctions have inflicted deprivation of medicines and food that has resulted in an estimated 40,000 deaths between 2017 and 18. Your reporter spoke with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and co-author of the report, along with economist Jeffrey Sachs. Here he outlines the findings of the report that looked into the deadly impact of U.S. sanctions on the Venezuelan people.
Yes, it's tens of thousands since August of 2017, when the Trump administration imposed broader financial sanctions that deprived the economy of credit. So we estimated more than 40,000 deaths from 2017 to 2018. Of course, it's very approximate. You can't know exactly how many, but it was based on the increase in mortality from 2017 to 2018. But it's a terrible thing. You know, it's very obvious. There are some people try to deny it because, you know, there are all kinds of people here who support these sanctions. In fact, anybody like Nancy Pelosi and other members of Congress who recognized a parallel government, that is, they recognized Juan Guaido as the so-called interim president when he declared himself president of Venezuela in January, that by itself imposes a whole set of sanctions in addition to Trump's executive orders, because what happens when this government recognizes a parallel government, which, by the way, is something they haven't done since, you know, the Nazis invaded countries in like France and Europe, and the U.S. recognized a government in exile. This is a very unusual, unprecedented thing to say, oh, we don't like the way your election was run in May of 2018, and then almost a year later you come back and say, oh, and by the way, since we didn't like that election and it was disputed, we're going to recognize this guy who our Vice President Pence called the night before and, you know, gave him the go-ahead to declare that he was president, somebody who, you know, hardly anyone in the country knew who he was before he did that. And so this is an extreme measure, but what it does that most people don't know, it creates this whole new set of sanctions, because any money that the sale of oil from Venezuela, which is the way they get almost all of their dollars, any money from that now goes to him instead of to the government, which means that both the government and the private sector are deprived of the money, the foreign exchange, the dollars that are necessary to import food and medicine and medical equipment and everything that hospitals need, and infrastructure for parts for water and sanitation. So that's why the main reason why you see this big increase in deaths. These kinds of sanctions have always been a war. They're like the wars of the Middle Ages, when you lay siege to a city and starve people. Amazingly, our Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was asked by Matt Lee, the reporter for the Associated Press, at a press briefing on March 11th. He asked him how this regime change effort was going, because clearly that was already 3 months since they first declared the presidency of Juan Guaido. And so Matt Lee said, "Are you satisfied with the pace of the momentum behind Guaido and his leadership?" And Pompeo said, this is his answer, and I'm reading it from the transcript of the press conference. He said, "Well, we wish things could go faster, but I'm very confident that the tide is moving in the direction of the Venezuelan people and will continue to do so. It doesn't take much for you to see what's really going on here. The circle is tightening. The humanitarian crisis is increasing by the hour. You can see the increasing pain and suffering that the Venezuelan people are suffering from." So you see, he's basically telling them that this is what's going to overthrow the government. And it hasn't succeeded yet, but that's their actual strategy. These tens of thousands of people are not even collateral damage, you know, like in a bombing. They're actually the point of the sanctions, so that people will become desperate, either topple the government, or the military will be convinced to topple the government, which is what they tried to do just a week ago.
What do you make of calls for dialogue and negotiations to end both the political and economic crisis in Venezuela, where the United Nations and the Vatican have offered to be mediators in such talks, in an effort to avert more pain and suffering and to avoid a future threatened Trump administration military intervention, or the possibility of proxy forces going to civil war, where certainly many more lives will be lost?
They said from the beginning they don't want any mediation. They don't want any kind of negotiation, because as soon as the Vatican announced it, they were willing to mediate if asked by both parties. Trump said no, and then Pompeo said no. The time for negotiations has passed. What they're really doing there is trying to avoid any kind of negotiated solution. And they're doing that by choosing Juan Guaido. He's with a party called Voluntad Popular, which has just 14 seats out of 167 in the National Assembly. And why did they choose him and his party? Because they don't want any kind of negotiation. Whereas probably most of the opposition would like to negotiate, or at least a good part of it, a much larger part than he represents.
That was Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and co-author of the report titled "Economic Sanctions as Collective Punishment, The Case of Venezuela." Find a link to the report and additional analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Democratic Party-controlled House of Representatives took its first historic step on April 30th to begin a national debate on the popular proposal to establish a Medicare for All universal health care system in the U.S. The hearing before the House Rules Committee focused on a bill recently introduced by Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat of Washington, called the Medicare for All Act of 2019, that would cover all Americans' health care needs and transition the nation to the program over the course of 2 years. One of the most impassioned speakers supporting Medicare for All at the hearing was Adi Barkin, a veteran health care activist who suffers from the degenerative neural disease, ALS, who used a computer to assist him to address the legislators. Your reporter spoke with Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive turned whistleblower and author. Here he examines what the nation's insurance industry will be saying and doing to stop the momentum of the movement supporting a transition to a universal single-payer healthcare system in the U.S., such as Medicare for All.
Well, it was a very, very historic hearing in that there never has been a hearing ever before in Congress on moving to a Medicare for All type of healthcare system. In fact, just 10 years ago, during the debate on what became the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as most people call it, no one from any single-payer organization was even given any serious consideration. In fact, at one point, during a hearing at the Senate Finance Committee, some supporters for single-payer health care were actually ejected from the hearing room and arrested because they were raising a ruckus, primarily because no one was paying attention to the efforts to try to move us to a Medicare for All type of health care system. Things have changed so much in those 10 years. More people are realizing that the Affordable Care Act, even though it did significant good, doesn't go nearly far enough to get us closer to universal coverage or control health care costs.
Wendell, on the insurance industry side, they are making claims that Medicare for All will drive taxes higher, that Americans will have less choice, longer waiting times for doctors and operations, lower quality, and there will be rationing of care. And of course, there are single-payer universal healthcare systems all across the developed world. In fact, the United States is the only country not to have a universal system. But tell us a bit about how you, as an insurance industry insider, responds to these arguments, which are, I think, really the boilerplate of how the insurance companies are going to try to derail efforts to move Medicare for All forward.
Well, they're using the same tactics they've used for decades to push back against any kind of reform that the industry doesn't like and that the industry feels might threaten profits, because at the end of the day, it's all for them about profits, about making money for shareholders. So they engage in what I've often referred to and what we referred to in the PR business as FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And all of these campaigns are based on lies and half-truths. That's one of the things I write a great deal about, is to help people understand that this is just all made-up stuff. Let's take them one by one. Yes, we're talking about a system that would be publicly financed but privately delivered. And, of course, you have taxpayers who would provide the funding for that. But what they obscure, what they don't tell you, is that the money will come from shifting premiums, money we pay into private insurance companies, into a single fund that will be administered much more efficiently. They talk about rationing. We have the most insidious form of rationing in the developed world. We ration on the ability to pay. Let's talk also about the choice issue. They maintain that this would take away choice. That is obscuring the reality of a current system in which insurance companies, our employers, are limiting our choices. It's not choice of health insurance plans that Americans are interested in. They want to have choice of doctors and hospitals. And increasingly, insurance companies are limiting our choices through these narrow networks that are features of almost all the health plans we have these days. So, in other words, they seek to mislead and obscure, and they lie, plain and simple.
Wendell Potter, are you optimistic that public pressure and aggressive legislators can move the ball forward on Medicare for All? Or do you think with all their money and all their influence, the insurance industry will win this fight?
I'm optimistic. And if I didn't think that it was winnable, I wouldn't be in this fight myself. I think it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when we have a Medicare for All type of health care system, because the current system is failing more and more of us every year. We're seeing that our employer-based system is crumbling, and it's just a matter of time before it collapses.
That was Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive turned whistleblower and author, who's founder of the investigative news platform Tarbell.org. Find a link to Potter's recent article titled "Propaganda Machine Stalls at Medicare for All Hearing" by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. students across the U.S. and world held a second youth strike for climate on May 3rd. In Connecticut, young and older activists convened outside the Capitol building in Hartford, where in addition to listening to short speeches, attendees had a chance to take a recycling quiz, make posters, and share their thoughts about the climate crisis. Then the students, mostly high schoolers and their adult supporters, participated in a press conference to add their voices to those of lawmakers and activists, promoting a number of environmental and climate bills in this year's legislative session. At the top of the list was an effort to roll back at least some of the legislature's reduction of funds that are collected on ratepayers' electric bills, explicitly to fund energy efficiency measures. $155 million was removed from this fund in 2017 in order to balance the state budget, and about half is already gone. However, the next installment is due to be taken in June of this year, unless the General Assembly votes not to. The state government won an initial lawsuit challenging what opponents charged was theft of these funds, and the case is now being appealed. One of the speakers was Mitchell Kuvidar, a Connecticut youth climate leader. Also speaking was Connecticut State Representative Robin Porter, who represents a low-income community in New Haven, where many residents suffer from the negative health effects of the burning of fossil fuels. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the Youth Climate Strike rally and press conference and brings us the following excerpts of their comments.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change states that we only have 12 years to drastically alter every aspect of our society and our economy. Every aspect must change to support a healthy path forward for everyone. This will be no easy task. No one says it will be, but it needs to be done. I'm a 19-year-old college student. Right now, I'm supposed to be studying for my pre-calc final. I'm here today because I think this is far more important. This is the most important issue of our time. The effects from unabated climate change will be devastating for both Connecticut and the entire world. We risk drastic sea level and flooding, billions to the economy, an uptick in deadly wildfires and droughts, the complete melting of the Arctic, and potentially a sixth mass extinction on both our land and seas, and economic and societal ruin as a result. As the communication director of the College Democrats for this state, the co-communications director for the Sunrise Movement here in Connecticut, and as a co-lead for the Connecticut Climate Strikes, I, for one, can tell you that this issue is one that the youth recognize as our greatest threat. Now, we expect all of you, our politicians and leaders, to recognize both our voices in this discussion and to listen to the science and act accordingly, because ignorance will not do any of us any favors. Ignorance will not win a re-election. Ignorance will not buy us time. Ignorance will make us replace you. The easiest way the state can make progress in the effort to fight climate change is through energy efficiency and reduction, and it comes with some great side effects. The Conservation and Load Management Plan is part of this answer. Yet the state keeps pulling funds from it and plans to once again this June. In effort to stop climate change, energy conservation and energy efficiency is our easiest and most effective way to eliminate greenhouse gas production. It is this simple. The less energy a building uses, the less power it needs, and the less fossil fuels that will need to be burned, regardless of where the power is coming from. With 10 years of investment, Connecticut has avoided building two new power plants, removed 11.4 million tons of carbon from our atmosphere. Now this means cleaner air. Cleaner air in a state that was just rated by the American Lung Association as having one of the highest asthma rates in this country. This is a public health crisis and a drain on our already strained health services. Efficiency has the incredible ability to lower expenses for residents, draw less energy from the grid, cut pollution, and strengthen our local green jobs. I myself come from a low-income household where my single mom continuously struggles to pay for electricity bill at the end of the month, and sacrifices are made. But it's not just me. This state has a huge number of residents that are unable to afford their energy bills. Over 400,000 residents cannot afford their energy bills, and that's because this state has the third highest energy cost per capita, and that's growing. Yet, when the Conservation and Load Management Plan was rated, it took away the ability to weatherize 13,000 homes, disproportionately hurting our low-income and underrepresented communities. Thousands of families, needlessly, have high energy bills because we took those funds away. And speaking from firsthand experience, no one, no mother or father, should have to choose to either skip their energy bill or send their son or daughter on a field trip or another school experience. No mother or father should have to sacrifice their own well-being in an attempt to try to do it all. And that is why I believe it should be among the first to take swift and decisive action against climate change, and energy efficiency should be a key part of that.
State Representative Robin Porter also spoke.
I was told the other day a story about a woman, an elderly woman, who had had her services turned off for electricity, and she needed $700 to turn it back on. But in addition to that, she needed over $500 for a reconnect fee. Where was she supposed to get that when she couldn't afford to pay the electric bill in the first place? These are real life issues. These are real life stories that are impacting people on a daily basis. And no one should have to choose between eating and keeping their lights on or keeping their gas on. That they're sitting up in their homes in the wintertime, you know, and they're not warm. Or in the summertime, you go in and it's just too hot. You can barely breathe. And the asthma and all these other things that are impacted, allergies. We have to care. We have to take action. And as it's been said, as lawmakers, it is our responsibility to hold our own feet to the fire and make sure we get this done and get some of it done this year. Thank you.
That was Connecticut State Representative Robin Porter, preceded by youth climate leader Mitchell Kovidar. Speaking at a May 3rd press conference following a youth climate strike rally at Connecticut State Capitol in Hartford. Learn more about the youth climate strike and local efforts to address climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Radio Helsinki in Graz, Austria, KRBX in Boise, Idaho, KYAQ in Toledo, Oregon, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.